From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Anthony Bourdain, the famed celebrity chef and award-winning TV host of CNN's Parts Unknown, was found dead in his hotel room in France over the weekend. His death by apparent suicide was a shock to fans of his show and his many books all over the world. What set Bourdain apart was his unique approach to food, as informed by its context, history, and the broader cultural and political forces that shape it and the people who grow, process, serve, and eat it. Through his extensive travels, Bourdain introduced Americans to the complexities of the lives of non-Americans, such as raising the context of the Israeli occupation when showcasing Palestinian food, or the legacy of Henry Kissinger in the context of Cambodian cuisine, or reminding us of the importance of honoring immigrant labor in U.S. restaurants. In the last months of his life, he became a male ally of the hashtag MeToo movement. We turn to Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. He's also author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, and a regular news correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Arun.
Great to be with you today, Sonali.
Well, I thought of you when I heard of Anthony Bourdain's death, because you're, you know, one of the few people that talk about the intersection of food and politics. But Bourdain didn't come into food through politics. He came into politics through food. What was your overall reaction, first of all, to the shocking news of his death? He was only 61 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly dismaying in terms of hearing that he had killed himself, and because he had been such a vibrant person, such a force of nature, you know, he was doing all these various shows, writing all these different books. So, you know, I think to everyone, it was quite a shock. But then it turns out that he had been struggling with depression and mental health issues all his life. And in fact, in one of his shows from Argentina, he visited a psychotherapist and talked about the fact that something as simple as a bad hamburger could send him into a spiral of deep depression for days. And when he was asked if he ever felt happy or life is good, he just instantly responded, no, never. So he was clearly someone who had these deep struggles. And I think in hindsight, we were fortunate to have him around for so long.
You write in an article that you did about him, a eulogy of sorts in Jacobin magazine, that that a lot of the mainstream media obituaries and discussions of his legacy miss the fact that first and foremost, Anthony Bourdain was a journalist. What made him a journalist?
Well, he was someone who was fundamentally interested in the daily lives of people. And what I said is, you know, food was his reporter's notepad and pen, that he was explicit about that, that if you're just a journalist, what you do is you parachute into a situation, you ask people a few questions, and they tighten up, and you really don't get honest answers. And this is something I very much discovered from my years of journalism, that you have to build relationships. And so food is just an incredible way to build a relationship. You see how people eat, you see what their daily lives are like, and over food, people will open up. And he said they will tell you extraordinary things that have nothing to do with food. But he wasn't just collecting curios, right? There have always been these travel shows. One of the most famous ones was CBS's On the Road with Charles Kuralt. And he would go around the nation in a RV, you know, like talking to quirky characters and volunteers and craftspeople. And that was not at all what Bourdain was doing. He very much had an agenda. And again, he was explicit about that as well. I mean, they would do the shows where it was just these, you know, the boys engaging in just this outrageous gluttony, where they would be eating, you know, these rich, fatty dish after dish of meats and cheeses and elaborate sauces, and he would do these buddy picks with these shows with his best friend, Eric Repair, who is a 3-star Michelin chef and is considered one of the best chefs in America. But if you really look at where he was going to, places like Congo and Cuba and Vietnam, Namibia, Gaza, and the West Bank, Mexico, and it's kind of on and on. These are countries that are basically official enemies of the U.S. And domestically, he would go to places like Montana, West Virginia, or Cleveland, or even, you know, in Houston. He wasn't focusing on the Anglo culture there. He was going to the Latino working class neighborhoods. He was going to places that had been essentially abandoned and abused by the neoliberal elite. So you find someone who is essentially using food to oppose the Washington consensus. And that was really what was extraordinary about him, especially when you see what he says during these shows.
Hmm. Well, food has become such an interesting phenomenon in our social media landscape, where you have, you know, hipster foodies photographing their food more than eating it. And we have this whole subculture of food porn, as it's called. But Anthony Bourdain approached food in a very interesting way. He didn't look down upon fast food or junk food. What was the significance of his approach to the cheap, tasty, maybe not the healthiest food that everyday Americans and even people outside America eat?
Well, it was all about context, and that's the thing. He was very materialist, that you had to see things in their context. So, for instance, when he went to Charleston, he was accompanied by this master chef, Sean Brock. And after a night of bourbon drinking, they went to a Waffle House, which is this chain in the South. And Sean, like, says, "I'm going to give you a tasting experience." And they order eggs and steaks and pork chops and hash browns, pecan waffles. And it's just this huge pile of food. And they're stuffing their face into it and just talking about the charms of a Waffle House at 3 a.m. where there's always a fresh pot of coffee. And it's just this kind of genuine slice of Americana and this camaraderie. And at one point, Bourdain, his mouth crammed with food, says, "This is better than the French Laundry, man." And the French Laundry is considered ranks as the top restaurant in all of the United States. It's one of these places where you go for these $400, 23-course tasting menus. But at the same time, in the same episode, he talks about Chili's being on the Mexican border and how he wants to go in and smash up the place with a tire iron, because he's just like, why the hell are there Chili's on the Mexican border? There's plenty of great Mexican food. Or he would get into spats regularly with a lot of prominent food figures, like Alice Water. Like she was would suggest that, oh, what kids in inner city really need is organic food. And Anthony Bourdain is just like, that's not what they need. What they need is safe schools, they need health care, they need good educational systems. Maybe after they get all that, then they need organic food. Or he went after her because she was criticizing Popeyes, the fried chicken chain, that people would line up at it. And he's like, people aren't lining up at Popeyes because it's healthy or organic or even tasty. And this is a point that I make in my own book, that fast food is not really that tasty. What it is cheap and convenient. And what Bourdain was saying is people were lining up there because it's 3 pieces of chicken for $1.99. And you have to understand that's why people go there. And Alice Waters' response is, well, maybe they need to think about that cell phone or third pair of Nikes. I mean, really condescending towards poor people.
And the sort of Republican approach of personal responsibility, you know, if you took care of yourself, you wouldn't fall sick and need health care, that sort of attitude.
And if I could just add one more anecdote, he tells this hilarious yet very telling anecdote about when he was in Namibia, or you can watch it in the show, where they're invited to kind of to a tribal dinner, and the chieftain, they kill a warthog. He pulls out the rectum of the warthog and grills it and offers it to Anthony Bourdain. And there he is looking at it, and he's like, it's covered in hair and sand and fecal matter, and he knows he's going to get sick. But he says, what's going on, though, is the chief is offering him what he considers the prize food. And in that context, to refuse it would be a grave insult to him and his people. So he says, like, look, you know, I know I'm going to have to chew a few antibiotic pills, but I'm going to take one for the team here, because to refuse him would be a grave dishonor. And what he was saying, it was all about context. And I think that that's something that is really is forgotten in our culture. And I think it's something that is often being forgotten on the left, the importance of social context. And every show is just this beautiful and sumptuous reminder of that.
You mean that it's not something that is done outside the U.S. where you inform your host of all your dietary needs before you go to dinner?
Well, you know, I as you know, Sonali, you know, I'm a professional chef and you're a wonderful cook, and I've decided like I'm no longer going to cater to anyone. I was in France, and they don't. When people invite you over, they don't cater to you. You're a guest, and they're honoring you. Now, if you can't eat something, you can't eat something. That's okay. Or if you have like real medical conditions. But the idea that you go over and make demands, I mean, it's a very colonialist mentality. And that is very prevalent on the left.
So staying with Bourdain's legacy, you mentioned Gaza as one of the places that he visited. And Gaza, of course, has been in the news recently. It's in the news constantly for decades now. This was an interesting feature in his show Parts Unknown, where he sometimes completely veers away from food altogether and simply talks about the cruelty of what he has witnessed. How important, and Gaza, of course, being such a controversial issue, the Israeli-Palestinian issue being so polarizing here in the United States, how important was what Bourdain said about Palestinians, Gaza, and the Israeli occupation, given that he occupied a space, a critical space, within mainstream media and had probably many followers or fans who didn't agree with his position on Palestine?
Oh, it was incredibly important. I've heard some people grumble about, oh, he wasn't saying anything new. And it's just like, yes, that's true. If you know, you're talking to 200 angry know-it-all leftists, sure, he wasn't saying anything new. He was talking to millions of people. And what he would do in many of these shows, you know, with Gaza, with Cuba, with Iran, he would start out like essentially parodying what the mainstream consensus. So these people are dangerous, they're a threat, so I decided to go there. And so during that episode where he goes to Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, the things he said are completely ordinary, but they're extraordinary because you never hear them in the mainstream media. So for instance, he says at one point there are 500,000 settlers living in the West Bank, and they're all in contravention of international law. Most are in contravention of Israeli law, and it doesn't make a difference. They're coming in larger numbers. Or when he goes into Bethlehem, into a refugee camp, throughout the episode, there are all these shots of the walls, of the Israeli apartheid wall, of barbed wire, of armed soldiers. And when he gets into the refugee camp, he says, you see the wall for what it is, a prison. And again, that is just something you will not hear in the mainstream news at all. Or in Gaza, simply all he was doing was showing them as human beings. And this was an instance of how he used food beautifully. He had two meals. He was taken around by Leila El Haddad, who is a cookbook and author of The Gaza Kitchen. And first, she takes him to a family meal, where they a husband and wife, which he notes is unusual, cook this large kind of like chicken and rice casserole. But then they just go like half an hour away to this other community in Gaza, where they have this men's only feast, other than El Haddad, of roasted young watermelon and squash, kind of this like almost panzanella salad with bread and yogurt. And what was interesting is she was explaining to him how this comes from a particular refugee community. And he would sit there and talk about their hopes and their dreams, like, do you think you'll ever see Jerusalem? Do you think your children will ever return? And he was showing that they have dreams also, and that there are multiple communities with different identities in Gaza. And so he was able to use food to really just smash this idea that the Gazans are this kind of nameless, faceless, monolithic enemy, almost this comic book enemy out of these movies that we see these days.
Right. If you read mainstream media, every resident of Gaza is a member of Hamas, ergo a terrorist. So I want to play for you and our audience a video of Bourdain in an acceptance speech that he recorded for an award given to him in 2014 by the Muslim Public Affairs Council. It's Voices of Courage and Conscience Media Award, and it was for the Israeli-Palestinian episode of Parts Unknown.
I'm very, very honored for this award, the MPAC Voices of Courage and Conscience Media Award. There was, however, very little courage, and one would hope an ordinary amount of conscience at work in producing our Israel-Palestine episode of Parts Unknown. I was enormously grateful for the response from Palestinians in particular, for doing what seemed to me an ordinary thing, something we do all the time, show regular people doing everyday things, cooking and enjoying meals, playing with their children, talking about their lives, their hopes, and dreams. It is a measure, I guess, of how twisted and shallow our depiction of a people is, that these images come as a shock to so many. The world has visited many terrible things on the Palestinian people, none more shameful than robbing them of their basic humanity. People are not statistics. That is all we attempted to show. A small, pathetically small step towards understanding. To be recognized in this way means a lot to me and to all of us who worked on the show. And for that, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thanks.
And that's a short video of the late Anthony Bourdain accepting an award from MPAC, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, for his humanizing of the people of Gaza. My guest is Arun Gupta, who's written about Anthony Bourdain's legacy in the latest issue of Jacobin magazine, which you can find online. Bourdain, who was found to have committed suicide last Friday. So let's also talk about how he was not afraid to take on individual people in power in the United States. One of my favorite quotes that I'm seeing being shared about him is what he said about Henry Kissinger after visiting Cambodia. Now, Kissinger, of course, feted by the Democratic Party establishment, became a target of very visceral language by Bourdain. He wasn't afraid, right, of taking on these folks?
Yeah, he had a tongue sharper than a chef's knife. He talked about, you know, if you go to Cambodia, you'll want to beat Henry. You'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands. You know, that this guy was a murderous, treacherous scumbag who is regularly feted by the, not just by the political establishment, by the media. And he said, this guy should never be able to get a meal in New York City. You know, the thing is, Bourdain had a really clear moral center, which again is very rare. He could have just spent his whole career doing these bro shows, traveling around, eating expensive or bizarre foods, but he was really taking a risk often. You know, he talked about with the what was called the Jerusalem episode, where they went all over Israel and Palestine, that he had to fight every step of the way to get the final show on. And, you know, he said, you know, they had to make some compromises, but in the end, he was pretty happy about it. But, you know, he also went after David Duke at one point, said he'd be happy to rearrange his knee or other extremities. He was recently asked, you know, if he was cooking a meal for a summit of King Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, what would he serve? And his one-line response was hemlock.
Hemlock. So,
yeah. You know, so he's very witty, but he's someone, I think, who really knew which side he was on. And that showed very much with the Me Too movement.
Right. Let's talk about that. He became his girlfriend, Asia Argento, is a central figure in that movement, having very publicly accused Harvey Weinstein of raping her. He, I think, seemed to have learned a lot from her about how to be in solidarity with women as this new movement arose, right?
Yeah, it was complicated for him because he came to prominence with Kitchen Confidential. And one of the things about Anthony
Bourdain, that's one
Bourdain,
of his early books, yeah.
That was his first
book.
Well, his first nonfiction book. He had written like two kind of like pulp crime novels in the mid-90s. But he was neither a gifted chef nor a natural writer, which a lot of journalists have been saying. He was like, I was a chef of middling ability. And as far as writing, he really worked at it. And those crime novels got pretty mediocre reviews, but it was Kitchen Confidential that really rocketed to fame because it's this kind of like rollicking, you know, it's lurid, it's aggressive, it's dramatic, it's at times violent, it's filled with like the drug, sex, and craziness of the New York restaurant scene. And I was cooking at the same time as him in New York City restaurants, and I'm like, how'd I miss all that? You know, the reality is what he was doing was telling a story. Later he acknowledged that he had helped validate what he called meathead bro culture. You know, kind of that aggressiveness, particularly macho aggressiveness in the New York City kitchen. So he couldn't undo that, but he very publicly came out and broke ties with various high-profile chefs like Mario Batali and this New Orleans chef, John Nash, who had been accused of multiple detailed allegations of sexual misconduct. And, you know, he very much said, you know, that you have to pick a side, and I know which side I'm on. And he attributed much of that to his girlfriend, Asia. And, you know, he even talked about how he was embarrassed by the fact that women didn't reach out to him before because of, you know, his attitudes, and that he had been part of that culture. So he was very much trying to make amends. But I think there's also an interesting element that often gets overlooked in his work, his television work, as it relates to women.
Well, that's right. I mean, he does also talk about how in a lot of his episodes, he showcases women who outside the country and other countries who do much of the work of food preparation, food serving, and get much little, you know, get very little of the actual credit, right? I mean, and that's a problem here in the U.S. more so than anywhere else, where we have this very male-centered chef, celebrity chef culture that is quite sexist.
Yeah, it's very true. Like when you hear a chef's name, like, you know, the Thomas Kellers and the Eric Ripers, I mean, there's the rare woman in there like Alice Water, but it's almost always appended to empire, right? That these people have empires, and they often do. They employ hundreds or even a thousand people or more. They have a dozen high-end restaurants and catering operations and branded products and cooking schools. But it's almost always men, and it's a type of form of enclosure. When he's going overseas in particular, he's going into people's homes, and he's acknowledging this is where the real great cuisine is. I mean, it sees him eating a lot. The shows also have him eating a lot of street food. But again, that's very interesting because street food is working class food. It's not this molecular gastronomy, you know, where everything is being done with tweezers and you know, it's perfectly arranged and they look like works of art, and that can be an incredible cuisine, but he was most interested in the connection. And you really see this in the Iran episode, I think, because what was extraordinary about that episode is so much of it is just the faces of people smiling and laughing and waving, and children and families. And he has multiple meals inside families' homes, and they talk about how the real Persian cuisine is very sophisticated, it's elaborate, it's time consuming, and it has to be done inside the home. And recipes are these treasured secrets handed down from generation to generation. And you see women preparing these incredible looking dishes, though in one case there is a male servant cook doing it. But he is recognizing on the one, that it's women who are largely responsible for the social and cultural reproduction around food. But secondly, what he was doing with that episode was he was basically asking Americans, like, are you willing to bomb these people, to starve them, to shoot them? Because we're on the march to war again, with the Trump administration. And he has just a couple of minutes of people in Isfahan, which is this just enormously beautiful city in terms of its Islamic architecture, of families like picnicking and praying. And it's really a touching way to see who the Iranian people were. And it's worth 1,000 news reports. That's what was so extraordinary about him, that you can watch hundreds of hours of news and you would never be able to glean the sense of humanity that he could give you in just a 1-hour show.
He also, it seemed to me, beyond food, through his shows, which took him all over the world, seemed to show an example of how an American can be a gracious guest in someone else's land, in someone else's home, and not the ugly, loud American stereotype that unfortunately can be all too true.
Yeah, he's always gracious. He's always welcoming. He's never condescending, you know. And some some shows are a full on attack on colonialism. Mm. Like in the Congo, you know, he talks about there's very little food in that episode. He's talking about the Heart of Darkness and King Leopold. He refers to it as a Holocaust, you know. In the Iran episode, he talks about how the U.S. backed Saddam Hussein, and he gassed Iranians with sarin and nerve gas, or that the U.S. and Britain were responsible for toppling Mossadegh in 1954. In the Puerto Rico episode, he just goes on and explains in detail about the vulture hedge funds, you know, the predatory banks that were unelected, unaccountable, and that are pillaging the social infrastructure just to pay off debtors. I mean, it's really quite amazing to see what he was doing with the show, and often it had very little to do with food.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Arun, for joining us today. We'll link to your piece about Anthony Bourdain from our website. Thank you, as always, and we're looking forward to your book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction.
Thanks again, Sonali.
Arun Gupta has been my guest. He's an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. And he's a regular news correspondent for our program. We've been discussing the legacy of Anthony Bourdain. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.